Oh, sure.
Right, let me start that over. I'm going to call the meeting here for June 15th to order. And Director Rowe, please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay, please rise. There's no flag here, but wherever your flag is, in your hand to your heart, repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands,
one nation,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for
all. Thank you, Kelly. Great. Let's please take the roll.
Roll call, Director Bilodeau.
Present.
Director Green. Director Mendoza. Director Wynn. Director Rowe.
Here.
Director Sheldon.
Here.
Director Ta.
I'm here.
Director Whitaker.
Here.
Director Yeo.
Here.
You have a quorum with six directors present.
Great. Are there any items that have been received which were too late to be agendized?
There are none.
Thank you. And we'll now go to visitor participation. Any members of the public like to speak on an item on our consent calendar or of public interest to the district? Please raise your hand on your Zoom if you'd like to do that. Now, if we see any hands.
I do not see any hands raised.
Hands, okay. All right, everyone's last call. So let's move on to the consent. And are there any items that directors would like to have pulled or recognized recognized an abstention?
President Sheldon, under the provisions of Government Code 84308, I need to abstain on items 5 and 6.
Okay, so is there a motion on the balance of the consent calendar?
So moved by Director Whitaker.
Okay, and is there a second?
I'll second it.
By Director Rowe. Great, please take the roll.
Roll call, Director Bilodeau.
Yes, with my two noted abstentions.
Director Green, Director Mendoza, Director Wynn, Director Rowe.
Yes.
Director Sheldon.
Yes.
Director Ta.
Yes.
Director Whitaker.
Aye.
Director Yeo.
Yes.
Okay, that motion carries with 6 yes votes, with Director Bilodeau abstaining on items number 5 and 6.
Okay, so we will have those two items in abeyance. If any objection by the board of directors, let's go to our first matter of consideration, which is the renewal of the 2022-23 tax and revenue anticipation notes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. And this item was discussed at committee, at the Admin Finance Committee. And this particular item requires that it be posted as a matter for consideration at the board meeting. Staff would be happy to give the presentation again if the board so chooses.
I believe we'll be fine without a presentation, since we had one before. It's in the board packet. Is there a motion on this item?
I move the recommended action, Director Yeo.
Thank you, Director Yeo. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Second by Director Bilodeau. Please take the roll.
Okay. Roll call, Director Bilodeau.
Yes.
Director Rowe.
Yes.
Director Sheldon.
Yes.
Director Ta.
Yes.
Director Whitaker.
Aye.
Director Yeo.
Yes.
Okay, that motion carries with 6 yes votes, with Directors Mendoza, Green, and Wynn absent.
Okay. Move on to our first update under informational items. And I will reach out to some directors as we get this update. So, Mike, do we have a presentation?
We do. It's my honor and privilege to introduce Dr. Megan Plumlee, our Director of Research. Megan's going to go over a few research projects that we've been working on this past year. So, Megan, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Good evening, President Sheldon, members of the board. Let me pull up my slides here, and hopefully, can everyone see me and hear me okay? Got a new setup. Great. In my office tonight. Good. All right. Are you seeing the, let me fix my slides? button here. Are you seeing the full screen there?
It's not yet in presentation mode.
Okay. Let me give it a minute. It is on my screen, so it might not be coming through yet. Do you see the full screen mode?
Not yet, but you can continue with the presentation.
Okay, so you kind of see the lesser version. Let me try to make it bigger.
You might need to do it first, then share it.
Yeah, let me just try.
Are you working off two screens?
Yes.
Actually, I shouldn't. Don't take any technical information from me because it's not complex.
Let's see here. Now all my controls disappeared. Here we go. I'm going to stop share and I'm just going to reload it again, see what happens.
There you go.
Great. All right.
There we go.
Cool. Okay. So tonight I want to give you a quick overview of some of our recent activities in the research department this last 6 months. I do this presentation about every 6 months or so, which is also the twice a year that we release our internal departmental update report. So every 6 months we issue this report for the board and different managers of the district to read about the projects we've got going on. One paragraph summaries with a few bullet updates of all our different projects. Currently we have 22 different projects and programs. And so this was attached to the submittal for this evening's presentation. And this time around, we've also added kind of a new component to the biannual report, which is a one-page research brief or project brief to go into a little more detail on a project that we focus on. So we chose one of the projects that I'll talk about tonight, so I won't go into too much detail here, but this is the one-page brief that was included on our parasitic acid study. I like to reflect on the past 6 months, kind of by the numbers as far as outcomes in some different categories, publications by the research team, conferences, and grants. I'm really excited about the last 6 months. We have some pretty high numbers here, which is nice to see, like 8 different publications in different peer-reviewed journals, a lot of really good journals. So these are publications that either we lead or we're co-authors with perhaps a university professor and their students on a paper. And then 8 different conference presentations at various conferences, and also a couple of webinar presentations, including giving a research and project talk as part of the OCWD webinar series in this past 6 months. And then 3 different grants awarded. So we have a new grant project with the Water Research Foundation on PFAS, and then a couple new USBR projects funded by their Pitch to Pilot program, or P2P, which is newer for us. We haven't gotten an award under that program before. And then the DWPR program, which we've gotten a few awards in the past before, which is their desalination and water purification research program. So we're very excited about these projects. So for today, I picked 3 different projects to give you a quick overview of what these projects are about. The first is a USBR research grant that we got awarded a couple years ago, and now this 2-year study is starting to wrap up. And then I'll talk about a couple other ongoing projects. So first, this USBR-funded study of this alternative biocide. So this project, you can see the R&D team there, Yana, Don, Han, and Andrew, who have all been hard at work for a long time on this study. Again, funding from the USBR, our partners on this project. So we're the leads for this project, and we're doing all the testing here at the district in our GWS plant. But our university partner for the project is Stanford. There's a couple different professors that have different roles on the project. And then our technology provider, which is the chemical provider, is Evonik. And so in this study, we're actually looking at whether it'd be possible to use parasitic acid in the plant instead of chlorine. So chlorine is very commonly used as a biocide to control fouling of the ultrafiltration and reverse osmosis membrane. So the idea here is to see if parasitic acid could be used instead. So our drivers for this project, so the background, you know, chloramine, as I said, is conventionally used. So we dose chlorine, but it forms chloramine when it reacts with ammonia in the water. And chloramine is actually a more gentle biocide compared to chlorine. So it's better for the membrane. So chloramine is commonly used in plants like ours for microfiltration or ultrafiltration and reverse osmosis. But it is known to form some unfortunate water quality issues, disinfection byproducts or DVPs. Some of these are regulated in terms of like allowable limits or concentrations in drinking water. But there's a whole long list of other types of DVPs that are not regulated. Stanford has the capability to analyze for these compounds. So, you know, the industry understands that whether you're talking about potable reuse, wastewater, drinking water, you'll get these DVPs at low concentrations when you use chloramine. But we don't expect to see those with parasitic acid. So that's one of the drivers. And also chloramine actually interferes just a little bit with the UV-AOP process, makes it slightly less efficient. And so, you know, another benefit of not having the chloramines would be and using parasitic acid would be this potential benefit to the UV process. And so others have looked at parasitic acid, but just not yet in our industry, potable reuse. So it's been looked at by conventional wastewater treatment plants as an alternative to chlorine and also by the food and beverage industry. So it was non-trivial to set up this project because of course we can't just throw it into the full-scale plant and switch in case it wouldn't work well with our many, many hundreds and hundreds of membranes in the full-scale facility. So we set up a pilot system, which was quite the feat. So the diagram is just to kind of show the complexity, but we have two ultrafiltration pilots comparable to microfiltration running in parallel that feed an RO pilot with different tanks in between and different and cartridge filters in between the UF and the RO, all meant to simulate as close as we can the full scale plant and be able to give the parasitic acid a try and compare it directly to chloramine performance. So 2+ years that we've been tweaking this and trying to get parasitic acid to work. So the good news is we think it works. It was really challenging though. On the UF side, we found that you can dose parasitic acid instead of chlorine and you can run UF successfully. And same with RO, we can run RO successfully. We at first tried a continuous dose, just that's typical, you know, just like how with chloramine, it's continuously dosed into the plant's feed water so that that biocide is always there in the background, helping control biofouling of the membranes. But we actually got, which is these gross pictures on the right-hand side there, a lot of fungus and bacteria growth in the cartridge filter. So it wasn't really a UFRO problem. It was a cartridge filter problem. We have an explanation for why that happened, but we're able to prevent it when the team tried intermittent dosing. And it works. So amazingly, we don't have any parasitic acid or chloramine, any biocide going into the feed for 3 hours at a time. And then we do a pulse of PAA for just a few minutes. So it's, you know, 3 hours off, 3 minutes of dosing and then off again. So, but we get good performance and possibly some cost savings there with the amount of chemical that would be used. And RO runs that way too. So where we landed was that it looks like intermittent dosing is the more feasible or way to make it work for parasitic acid in our facility. So I'll quickly move on to the next project I wanted to talk about, which is kind of a group of different RO technologies that we want to test at full scale in this case in the plant. But a little bit of background first. We actually have a great sort of testing platform within the full scale plant because there are some spare positions for membranes, so we can put in different membrane technologies and try them out at full scale. So our RO plant features 8 of these sort of extra positions. So the white tubes that you see in the picture, those are pressure vessels, and they each hold 7 RO membrane elements. But at 8 different spots, we have an extra one. So when you walk around the plant, you might notice sort of that asymmetrical extra vessel sitting on top of some of the units. So that's our satellite vessel program. That's what we call them. And R&D oversees this program where we use those positions to test new membranes. And some of them are connected on the first stage of the RO process and some on the third stage. So it lets us try those 2 different types of RO feed waters. So this program has been going for a while. We call this the RO Membrane Qualification Program, and it's really just designed to give us a chance to evaluate new commercially available RO membranes, because the manufacturers are always coming and saying they have a great new type of membrane and they think it'll run great on the plant, and they do their modeling. But we want to test that first. And so we take their products and we run it in the plant for 6 to 12 months and do and have certain criteria. And otherwise, RO membrane selections would really just be based on, you know, facility references and recommendations or vendor claims. So that's why these pressure vessels or extra satellite vessels exist. But we're also in this next year or so going to be using some of these positions for kind of more novel technologies. So that's kind of a new thing for these satellite vessels, because we've actually had some pretty compelling conversations with a number of different startup companies and just, you know, non-startup, more established companies that have new technologies, and they're able to construct these technologies at the full scale element size so that we can kind of skip the pilot step and go right to a full scale test, which is most realistic anyways, most representative. And I should mention that the water that's produced, the permeate, does go to a waste line from these satellite vessels. So it's not, you know, blended into the main plant's RO permeate, but it gives us that full scale testability. So these are kind of the technologies we're looking at. Terraform has a new type of feed spacer, which is a component of the RO membrane element. And Aqua Membranes has one too, but theirs is 3D printed. So they actually spent over $1 million, you know, building this big 3D printer that can print RO feed spacers. So you can do all kinds of crazy patterns and cool designs. And then Water Surplus has a membrane coating that's supposed to reduce fouling. And then Nala Membranes is a startup that's been getting a lot of attention and press because they say they've manufactured the world's first chlorine tolerant RO membranes. Normally you have to use chloramines because chlorine is too strong and it breaks down the RO membranes and destroys them. But chlorine is a really good chemical cleaning agent. So being able to use RO membranes that we could clean with chlorine would be a big breakthrough. So we're going to be, I think, our first partner in the potable reuse space trying these membranes out. So crossing our fingers and hoping, you know, maybe at least one of these four things will work out. I don't know. We'll see. Okay, so PFAS pilot update. You've all heard my presentations in the past about our ongoing PFAS piloting. So just have a quick update for you tonight. We're still running this pilot. Just as a reminder, by way of background, our first phase of piloting, we tested 14 different adsorbents in parallel, looking for what would be a long-lasting, good performing adsorbent that we could use in the producer's groundwater production well treatment systems at the wellheads for these different wells throughout the basin that are impacted by PFAS. And so that phase of work identified that one ion exchange resin in particular, the Evoqua PSR2 Plus, had a really long life compared to the other media we tested. So that one stood out and has now been installed in some of the first plants that have come online. And then we had similarly good performance of an alternative adsorbent that's called Fluorosorb 200, manufactured by Setco. So that was phase one. And you can see the building there in the lower right picture where we house the pilot skid next to our recharge pond Warner Basin in Anaheim. But since then, we've continued to use this facility. And as certain adsorbents come to the end of the test, we swap in a different adsorbent. And so we've done a second phase of testing. And now we started a third phase of testing with just putting in new types of adsorbents. And so the punchline here is that so far, based on the conclusion of our second phase, we have not identified any media that has any, you know, better performance than the Evoqua PSR2 Plus or the Fluorosorb 200, based on looking at four different new ion exchange products and one additional alternative adsorbent. This is the table that shows all the different products we're looking at in phase two on the top. And then phase three is the ones getting started more recently. So it remains to be seen whether one of them may outperform any of the prior products. And then a few future candidates in the works as far as alternative adsorbents. But most of what we're testing is ion exchange products. And then just a couple highlights of some results I wanted to point out from the recent pilot work that was interesting. So we actually decided to run kind of a retest or a confirmation run of the Evoqua PSR2 plus ion exchange resin that had tested well in the first phase. So the green line is the original data showing the good performance of the PSR2 plus resin. The y-axis is percent breakthrough of PFAS, so you want that to stay low. And then the x-axis is time. So you can see that for a really long time, over 20 months, the PSR2 plus resin kept the PFAS concentration low. We didn't get to 60% breakthrough until after 20 months. And at full scale, you would never actually let the PFAS breakthrough get that high. We just do it at pilot scale to kind of develop the full breakthrough curve. So the good news is when we reran the PSR2 plus again, just you know, a year and a half later, loaded in new PSR2 plus resin, ran it again, and we get more or less the same result. So the solid orange line is the retest result, and it largely agrees with the original test. But what's interesting is we also trialed a faster approach to piloting, which is the dashed orange line. There's kind of a debate in the industry about whether it's okay to use this faster method, whether it's representative, but it's nice, you know, to get it done in, you know, 10 months instead of 20 or 6 months instead of 12. And so we actually got some good findings because when we do the faster approach and then we scale the data to do the full scale projection, that dashed orange line is basically the same as the other line. So it shows that at least for this product, it's okay to do the faster approach. So soon we'll be kind of sharing this information out with the industry and at conferences. So we think that's a pretty important finding that really kind of helps the industry at large think about how to do pilots in a timely way, since water agencies often need to make these treatment decisions pretty quickly to respond to a PFAS issue if they have one. And I won't go into too much detail on this next slide, but it's basically the same thing showing that for this Fluorosorb new type of alternative adsorbent, which is the pink lines, we also see that doing the faster piloting approach, basically in the dashed line there, gave us similar, you know, the same prediction as the more conventional pilot approach. So that was good news. So we kind of validated now with a different product that this faster approach to piloting can be okay. We did, however, see that this new offering of a new type of Fluorosorb called Flex from SETCO does not perform as well as Fluorosorb 200, which is the purple line that we tested in our first phase. So, you know, since Fluorosorb 200 had done very well in our phase one, again, the purple line there, SETCO let us know they had a new type of Fluorosorb that they thought, you know, might perform as well or even better. But unfortunately, it breaks through earlier as far as the PFOA, which is why the pink line is shifted to the left there. So with that, if there's time, I can take any questions. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm doing a couple things here at once. I apologize. Thank you for the presentation. Am I live?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good, thank you. Okay, for the presentation, are there any questions?
Director Rowe has his hand raised.
Thank you, Director Rowe.
Yes, thanks for the presentation. I recall reading in the weekly summary from staff last Friday that research has a small team of people who are looking to try to reduce silica in our waters. And you're going to be growing diatoms. Is that essentially what you're doing?
Yeah, so we're not organisms. That's right. We're not leading the project ourselves, so we can't take credit for that. But a professor who we worked with a long time before, Kasuke Ikihata with Texas State University, has long time been studying this concept where maybe you could have this natural bioreactor that you grow diatoms, which is a type of single cell algae in there. And it's, you know, you with sunlight, right? And you treat the water with the diatoms to remove silica. So they see it as a potential pre-treatment since silica causes a lot of fouling of RO membranes. So for example, if we were to try to take our RO concentrate and treat it with a membrane technology, perhaps it's better to treat it first with something like this to remove all the silica. And the
what's the silica content in our water that we're going to be doing this testing on?
You know, off the top of my head, I'm not sure the concentration. I think they are okay. Using the RO concentrate, so I'm not sure.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
Great. Any other questions? That was a great presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Apologize. I was trying to manage this board, all the participation and
multiple screens.
So I apologize. So and thank you very much. So at this time, I'd like to bring us back. I believe if we have seven directors present, is that correct, Christina?
I believe we do.
While I'm thinking of it, and I'm sure I'll be reminded, but let's, before we go back to the next presentation, that we'll go to the items on consent that were, that we deferred, and I'll make a motion for those items, and if there's a second.
I'll second it.
Second by Director Rowe, please take the roll.
Roll call, Director Bilodeau.
I am abstaining due to Government Code 84308, and this is items 5 and 6.
Yeah, we know why you're abstaining. You've already said that.
Director Green?
Yes.
Director Mendoza? Director Nguyen?
Yes.
Director Rowe?
Yes.
Director Sheldon?
Yes.
Director Ta?
Yes, I just had a question that, so we have to vote again on the consent calendar? I'm really sorry.
This is just for items 5 and 6.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, okay. Yes, yes, yes.
Director Whitaker?
Aye.
Director Yeo?
Yes.
That motion carries with 7 yes votes, with Director Bilodeau abstaining and Director Mendoza absent.
Thank you. I do apologize for the confusion that I created by our voting here, but we wanted to keep the ball rolling. And so we had to come back just to those couple items that we had deferred. So now
I apologize. My meeting went late.
No apologies needed, but thank you very much. So we will now proceed to our next item on our agenda regarding an update on the federal activity on PFAS. And I'll turn it back over to Mike Marcus, and we'll turn it over to Jason Daddy.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Yes, there was some activity actually today. And so this is a very current issue, and Jason Dadakis will be giving an informational report to the board this evening. Jason.
Great, thanks, Mike. Good evening, President Sheldon, members of the board. Janice or Christina, can I go ahead and share my screen? Great. Great. Can everyone see that okay?
Yes.
Excellent. All right, so yes, wanted to provide the board with this informational item tonight on some revised EPA health advisories that were issued by EPA earlier today. So I have a short presentation covering that. Just for the record, we did get an inkling of this happening late last week, and so we were able to agendize it on the board's agenda tonight. However, the presentation that was attached in your packet did not obviously contain the specifics that were released today. So the presentation I have for you tonight is a little bit different from that, to reflect those specifics that were released today. And my understanding is this revised presentation has been posted to our website.
Jason, before you commence, I'd just like to ask the board their pleasure if they could hold their questions, and we will have a closed session on this item, and we can have a dialogue as our attorneys allow us on under the Brown Act. But unless something's very generic, let's just try to hold all our questions until we have the right time to do that because of the litigation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, President Sheldon. So let's start out with in terms of what is an EPA health advisory. This is something that comes from federal EPA back in Washington, D.C., and these are non-enforceable drinking water levels that are intended to provide technical guidance to state regulators, public health officials, and water utilities. There are a handful of these issued by EPA for a couple of PFAS, PFOA and PFOS. EPA last issued these back in 2016, and they have now felt the need to update these with the revisions that came out earlier today, this morning. So this table attempts to summarize those new health advisories that are highlighted here in yellow. They released 4 of them today. They updated the health advisory for PFOA and PFOS. Previously set in 2016, it was set at a combined 70 parts per trillion for the sum of PFOA and PFOS. As you can see today, they bifurcated those and set up individual health advisories for them at much lower levels. We're looking at sort of 0.004 nanograms per liter for PFOA and 0.002 nanograms per liter for PFOS. And it's important to note here that these health advisories and where they're set are far below our lab and really any other, you know, commercial lab doing these types of tests, the sensitivity of those tests and their reportable detection limits. And so this is well below our capacity to detect these. And so what that effectively means is any detection of these in a water supply essentially would exceed the health advisory. You also see listed below are two additional compounds that EPA released new health advisories for, PFBS and GenX. I won't go into detail on those because they're much less relevant to us here in Orange County, because we either don't find these at all or certainly don't detect them at anywhere near these new health advisory levels. So I won't dwell on those latter two. But for PFO and PFOS, these are more relevant to us in Orange County and the basin and the producers. So what's the basis for these? What new information is EPA citing to support the need to revise these health advisories? They're based on new information EPA has received and specific studies looking at the immune system and basically how children who have been exposed to both PFOA and PFOS respond to vaccinations for tetanus and diphtheria. So this is the very specific endpoint that EPA is considering here, and that they have found supporting literature that shows that with these levels of exposure, you start to see the antibodies in children don't form as well after vaccination. That is the endpoint that's driving these numbers as low as they are. And if you can just compare this again to, you know, the sort of the reference doses or toxicology values that were used back in 2016, shown on the left here, they were 20 nanograms per kilogram per day. The most recent values driven by this new endpoint are, you know, 4+ orders of magnitude lower. You can see on the chart on the right, that's shown on a log scale, just showing the difference, the new values in orange, the older values in blue. This is why you get essentially a 4+ order of magnitude difference in the health advisory, is because these risk levels have been lowered based on the new studies that have been evaluated by EPA. So in addition to just putting these values out there, EPA also today has issued some recommendations for water utilities in terms of their actions. Should they identify, you know, supplies above these health advisory in their drinking water? Again, these are non-enforceable, these recommendations, but I do want to walk the board through them. The first thing EPA recommends is additional monitoring to confirm that indeed you have detections above the health advisory and perhaps to initially assess the source of them. EPA further recommends that local customers and residents be informed. Interestingly, EPA doesn't give any specific guidance on exactly how they recommend utilities do this. And so this could be interpreted in that simply by letting customers know through the annual consumer confidence report would be sufficient in terms of providing this the public notification, but not much specificity from EPA on exactly how to do this. EPA does recommend that utilities examine steps, and this is their exact language, examine steps to limit exposure above these concentrations. And they give a few examples of what this might look like: consideration closing wells, blending to reduce the concentrations below the advisory levels, certainly installing treatment at a source like a well. They also consider, perhaps in certain communities, installing in-home treatment or filters to reduce the concentrations below this level. Again, these are EPA's recommendations. Interestingly enough, EPA specifically in what they released today stated that they are not recommending that bottled water be provided to communities with that show, you know, levels above the health advisory there. I think there was some question in the prior health advisory back in 2016, especially some communities in the East Coast, in terms of, you know, should they be, is this something they should be doing? EPA was very explicit in today's advisory that this is not something they're recommending in terms of the provision of bottled water. So just want to do a quick comparison of these new health advisories with our state regulations and the state advisories that we are all operating under here in Orange County. So this table shows again those mood advisories in yellow. And you can see in comparing them to the draft public health goal that was put out late last year by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, at least for PFOA, it's a pretty comparable number. Again, in that below detection limit, sort of that picogram per liter level or very low nanogram, sub nanogram per liter level, there is some resemblance to that. And recall in California, public health goal is purely a health-based value, no consideration given to can you detect it, can you treat for it to this level, no consideration of cost of treatment or even what the benefits would be statewide. This is a purely health-based number. It appears that the methodology that EPA has taken for WHO's health advisory has followed a similar path of being purely health-based and picking a very conservative study to underpin it. As we look at the comparison to the California advisory response and notification level shown on the right side of this table, you can see they're well above the new health advisory. These are the advisories that the state has had out for a couple of years now. And these have to have a little more basis in what you can detect and a little more meaningful that way. They're at 10 and 40 nanograms per liter for PFOA and PFOS. And these response levels have really been what have driven our and the producer's actions in terms of continuing to operate wells and whether or not to design and construct treatment for them has been that California response level. Because that response level carries the recommendation from the state that water not be served above it. So just to talk a little bit more about this, back in 2018, when DDW set its first response levels for these compounds, they actually chose to set it at the health advisory level, that 70 parts per trillion combined. That was the first level they set at. So there was some, at that time, some equivalence given between an EPA health advisory and a California response level back in 2018. However, the state has subsequently lowered that health advisory to the 10 and the 40 you see in the table below, a table above rather. And so we checked in with some senior staff at DDW regarding this new development from federal EPA in terms of how they're interpreting it, how this may inform their future regulatory actions. And so I'll just summarize it in these bullets here. Based on these conversations we've had, and it sounds like the State Division of Drinking Water is not, at least today, inclined to revisit its state notification response levels on the basis of this new health advisory. They're satisfied that the response level and the notification level are serving their purpose. I think they believe that for it to be meaningful, both the notification response level have to have some correspondence with what you can detect. They currently do. Were they to be lowered any more than they currently are, they would not. I think they're really viewing now, you just see that compare the numbers, especially for PFOA, they're viewing EPA's health advisory as something more akin to their state public health goal, which is non-enforceable. And so it appears, at least today, that state drinking water regulators are really more focused on getting those state public health goals finalized by the end of the year and then completing their process to come up with an enforceable standard over the next 2 to 3 years. They really have their eye and their focus on that. It doesn't appear, at least initially, that this health advisory is gonna alter that focus. I will say one of the real impacts this may have in California is at Department of Defense sites, where traditionally Department of Defense that perhaps had releases of some of the firefighting foams that contain PFAS have been less responsive to initiating investigation cleanup at their sites with the state advisory levels, so the notification response level, but were more responsive to the federal health advisory. And so the thought is that perhaps this may spur action at some DOD sites with this lower federal health advisory. The one caveat I want to give this is obviously this just came out today. It's very new, very fresh for the state regulators. And this obviously has not been vetted through the state board members that oversee them in Sacramento. So in conclusion, just want to suggest some next step that staff are considering with this, again, this new information and new advisory that came out today from EPA. Obviously, this is something we need to discuss with the producers. Ultimately, as the local drinking water utilities, they are the ones who these advisories are most applicable to. And so we need to have a conversation with them in terms of how they intend to operate their systems with these new advisories versus the existing state advisories that they've been operating under for a few years now. Obviously with the state regulators, the state side, we will stay in close contact with them. One thing we know that should their initial sentiment change and they want to make a change to their notification or response level advisories based on legislation that's been adopted into law over the last couple of years, they must publicly notice this and actually present it to the state board. So in the event they decide to do this, water utilities and the rest of the community would have some awareness of it, that it's pending. Otherwise, they're expecting their public health goals to be finalized by OEHA by the end of the year. And that they believe that equips them to come up with their own enforceable standards to be put into law by 2025. On the federal side, it's interesting, you know, right on the heels of this announcement today, we're expecting later this year, this calendar year, to get EPA's enforceable national regulation. They have put that out publicly that the administration expects EPA to do this, and EPA administrator is committed to this timeline. We expect a proposed rule, which is essentially kind of like a draft rule, to come out by the end of this year. And it'll be very interesting to see how that enforceable standard compares to this health advisory that just came out a few months prior. We expect the final rule to be out by the end of the following year, end of 2023, and then under the Safe Drinking Water, be adopted into law. And then Safe Drinking Water typically has a 3-year compliance period at most, so that compliance would be required no later than 2026 under this timeline. So that concludes my presentation. And I'm available for any questions the board might have this evening. Thank you, Jason.
Any questions of a hopefully general nature? Okay, I don't see any questions, any hands up. Christine, do you see any of our directors?
No hands.
Great. Thank you very much, Jason. Okay, let's move on to our water resources summary.
I'm sorry, Mr. President. The information is contained in the packet.
Thank you. And we'll move to our SOPA report.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. At our recent SOPA Commission meeting, we received an informational report on an item that will appear before the commission soon. An Arundo Headwaters project opportunity with Inland Empire Resource Conservation District. This is an effort to help control, eradicate Arundo Donax. And why the headwaters are important focus area for Arundo removal are that Arundo seedlings can wash down waterways during rain events. And starting at the top of the watershed and working down is an economical way of approaching eradication. Many of you are familiar with Arundo, but I do want to recount some of the facts about it. Arundo donax is a giant cane. It grows 9 feet to 18 feet tall, can reach up to 30 feet tall. It's native originally to Southern Europe, North Africa, temperate Asia, including India and Japan. It is an invasive plant, and it has a high rating as a noxious weed. Uses approximately 528 gallons of water per meter annually. It's highly combustible. It survives fire and thrives. It causes flooding by altering flow regimes and offers no known habitat benefit. Since 2004, SOPA has implemented Arundo donax invasive weed removal projects that have covered approximately 6,000 acres in the Santa Ana River watershed and have saved an estimated 43,000 acre feet of water per year in that effort. The cooperation that SOPA staff has been working on with Inland Empire Resource Conservation District will apply first 2 years of mechanical removal, and that would be followed up by 3 years using an EPA-approved herbicide for any regrowth that would happen. This total project costs are estimated at $150,000 over a five-year timeline. And this would cover 13 sites, totaling a little over 10,000 acres. As I mentioned, this item will reappear before the SAPA Commission for authorization, probably at our next meeting. The other two items that we dealt with, we adopted a resolution to authorize application for a grant under the 2021 Urban and Multi-Benefit Drought Relief Grant Program for disadvantaged community set-aside funding. This through OWOW as well would be the document necessary to submit the application and would designate SAPA General Manager Jeff Mosier to sign the application and to execute funding agreement and all necessary documentation. The third item was, and we've spoken about this recently, authorized issuance of a request for proposals for the Santa Ana River Watershed Weather Modification Pilot Program's Operation Services. The good news on this item that I want to report is that we've had contributions pledged from local agencies, I believe eight local agencies, of about $93,000 to help offset costs. And should we be successful with grant funding, it will do much to reduce the estimated project cost of a little over $1.5 million, to in the high $900,000 range. Should we receive that grant assistance and also these contributions from local agencies. And that was pretty much what was covered in our recent meeting. I would be open to any questions, and details are also in the packet.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions? Comments? Okay, we'll move on to our next report pertaining to the Anaheim representative on our board. Is there a report on this, Mike?
Just a very short report, Mr. President. We did receive official notification from the city of Anaheim removing former director Sadu from our board. And I believe the city has put out a notification that they are interviewing members of the public that might be interested in serving as OCWD's representative. And I believe they are taking up the matter next Tuesday, June the 21st.
Thank you.
And that ends my report.
Great. We'll now go to the committee conference meeting reports with the first is property with Director Bilodeau, Chair Bilodeau.
You know, Director Yeo ran most of the meeting and the minutes are contained in the packet.
Thank you. For the Water Issues Committee with Director Green.
Details are contained in the packet.
And the Admin and Finance Committee with Director Ta.
Mr. President, the information contained in the packet.
Thank you. Next, we move to any committees, conferences attended by directors that were majority of the board was present. Attended at district expense where majority of the board was present. I don't hear any reports there. We'll now move on to the president's report and just steady as she goes. And we're always working on more water supply. So let's move to the general manager's report.
Nothing to report.
Director's report. Any directors like to make a report?
Yeah, this is Kelly Rowe. I'd like to report that I still haven't talked to Dr. Ralph yet, but I do have a telephone appointment with him yesterday to answer the one question I posed at their last board meeting.
Great. Thank you. Anything else? Any other directors? All right. I don't see any other directors. Everyone have a great evening. It's still sunny, nice out, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.